for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Bush administration will send a diplomat to international talks attended by Iran, and the Iranian foreign minister calls the move, quote, a new positive approach. The surge of combat troops ends in Iraq, while the U.S. considers bolstering forces in Afghanistan. And Hezbollah celebrates Israel's return of Lebanese prisoners in exchange for the bodies of Israeli soldiers. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Tom Jelton of NPR, Hisham Melam of Al Arabiya TV and on Nahar, and Roy Gutman of McClatchy Newspapers. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good
Happy
morning.
Friday. Tom Jelton, the White House is sending Undersecretary of State William Burns to Geneva tomorrow for these EU-led discussions with Iran's nuclear negotiator. Is this a major policy shift for the Bush administration?
It is, Diane, regardless of what they say. Now, the White House position is that this is a, quote, new tactic, not a new policy, because they say that the conditions for talking to the Iranians have not changed, which is that the Iranian government must agree to suspend its enrichment of uranium before there are real talks. Nevertheless, what is happening is that, as you say, Undersecretary William Burns is going to sit down at a table face-to-face with the Iranian government representative. This will be the highest level contact between a U.S. government representative, a U.S. diplomat, and the Iranian government since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. So that is a remarkable change, and it's one that we would not have expected on the basis of what the administration was saying just a few weeks ago.
Well, and Dana Perino, the White House spokesperson, Hisham, is still saying nothing has changed. Why do they hold to that statement in the face of clearly something else happening?
Because in essence, they are backtracking from a seven-year policy of boycotting any kind of serious negotiations or approach or engagement with Iran. This is extremely huge, extremely significant. There's a difference in focus and in style, and I think the beginning of shift in policy. And I heard a few things about the internal deliberation that led to this. In fact, it was William Burns himself, when he was ambassador in Moscow, when he was asked by Secretary Rice, expressed an interest to do exactly that with Iran. Because if you remember, Diane, it was William Burns who achieved the agreement with Libya to scuttle its program of weapons of mass destruction. And he has been pushing for this for a long time. Beyond that, for a full year now, many people at the State Department involved in Iran, including from the Iran desk up to Nicholas Burns, who was succeeded by William Burns, no relations there, wanted to approach Iran, to engage Iran. And Condi Rice was leaning in that direction, and the resistance kept coming from you know where, from the quarters of the vice president and some people at the NSC. And finally,
but now,
there are, I think, Condi managed to convince the president that this will bolster our approach, it helps our European allies, it puts more pressure on the Iranians, and let's see what happens. Now, they are spinning it, is that, well, Bill Burns is going to listen. Bill Burns is, by the way, I mean, he's one of the best experienced
veteran
diplomats. I've known him for many years. He was the assistant secretary of the Middle East when Colin Powell was secretary of state. He served in Jordan, served his country in Moscow.
So
he knows the Middle East, he knows Arabic, he knows Iran very well, and he's a diplomat's diplomat, and I think he's the best choice. He's not going to go there just to listen, and he's going to make a good case for the Americans and for the five plus. And I think one of the problems now is that he's going to face Saeed Jalili, who is an extremely tough more intransigent than Ali Larijani, who replaced. Jalili, by the way, is a veteran of the Iraq-Iran war. He worked in Khamenei's office, okay? And he's close friend of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and supposedly he was the one who wrote the letter that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad sent to President Bush. So he's going to be dealing with a tough Iranian negotiator.
So, Roy Gutman, what can we at least hope for that might come out of this meeting?
I think the immediate hope would be for an understanding. It's sort of like talks about talks. It's to sit down and have really serious talks about how to end the confrontation, how to get the Iranians to stop expanding their centrifuge capacity that could lead to nuclear weapons.
And
fuel.
How would we do that? What would we offer?
Well, actually, sitting down and talking to them is probably the first step. The administration had resisted this and had set preconditions. They said that the Iranians had to act first. The Iranians said, we are a sovereign nation. We do not submit to preconditions. And so, in a sense, what they've done now is finesse the preconditions by having him at the table. What's so interesting to me is that, in a sense, both countries have a very strong interest in moving this ahead right now. The Bush administration is in its last 6 months. The military option that they have said is on the table it truly is unrealistic. A U.S. intervention or U.S.-Israeli intervention of some kind would lead to possibly endless war with Iran, raise fuel prices into the stratosphere, and knock the Middle East into yet more confusion and more chaos. And I think they've realized that, if they didn't already sooner, that this is not an option. For the Iranians, and so in a sense they've run out of the military option. For the Iranians, the prospect of further economic sanctions by Europe, by Britain and France, the seizure of or the freezing of the assets of the Bank Mellie, this giant Iranian bank, is a very sobering prospect. They also have internal problems with their own economy, and both countries have an interest, a common interest, in bringing a more stable situation to Iraq and also coping with the insurgency in Afghanistan.
Diane, Roy mentioned how the administration and the Iranians and the Europeans are finessing this whole situation in order for Iran to be able to sit down, the United States to be able to sit down without admitting that they
are
doing
going
so.
To sit down.
And they've come up with a very imaginative proposal that is a basically for a 6-week interim agreement where the West has been, the Europeans and the West have been moving towards tougher sanctions against Iran. The West will agree to hold off on that entire sanction tightening program in exchange for Iran basically not expanding its nuclear program during this six-week period. Both achievable objectives, and it would allow both sides to say that they're moving forward even without having made any clear concessions.
Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Hisham Mellem, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya TV, and Roy Gutman. He's foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Your email, please, to drshow@wamu.org. Hisham, the surge of combat troops in Iraq ended this week. Are we heading towards additional drawdowns of troops in Iraq?
As you said, now the forces that were sent last year have achieved mostly their military, purposes.
And they succeeded, were 30,000.
Yes, they succeeded in the greater Baghdad area, bringing more stability there, lowering the level of violence. The same thing in Al-Anbar. This was coupled by some smart tactical moves, political moves in Anbar in particular, thanks to the stubbornness and the intransigence and the brutality of Al-Qaeda, which alienated many Iraqis, particularly Sunnis in that part of Iraq. So that was important. We have a marked reduction in the number of attacks against Americans as well as Iraqis, from 1,400 attacks a day to 400, which is, still large, but in terms of casualties, we have less casualties, Americans as well as Iraqis. So there is a marked improvement in the security situation. Now the challenge is the to achieve the main purpose of the surge, which is to create the environment that would lead to political reconciliation. Here, the Iraqis have not done very well, but they have moved on this road further probably than many of the skeptics believed. Nouri al-Maliki was willing to use the Iraqi army against some renegade Shia groups in the south, Muqtada al-Sadr and the so-called special forces in the south. That is helping the Americans to make the case to the Sunni Arab states to help him by saying, look, he's not acting as a Shia prime minister. The problem now is that you have a reduction in violence in Iraq and you have an increase in violence in Afghanistan.
Exactly. And how much of a shift in troops are we likely to see in to Afghanistan, Tom?
Well, Secretary Gates says that he would like to add up to 18,000 American troops to Afghanistan.
Where are they coming from?
Well, first of all, they're not coming. They're not going to go to Afghanistan anytime soon. This is going to take several months for him to be able to come up with the additional troops to beef up that presence. The administration is now talking about dropping two combat brigades by the end of 2008 from Iraq, but that's not going to be sufficient to come up with 18,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. For one thing, you can't take them out of Iraq and send them to Afghanistan. That is just not going to work. It doesn't work in terms of the rotation. So it's going to be a real logistical personnel resource management issue to figure out where are we going to come up with these troops to beef up our presence in Afghanistan.
So since May, the U.S. has lost 6 service members in Iraq, 21 in Afghanistan. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of the comment about Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Stay with us. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. And this week, Tom Gelton, you reported on a very, very disturbing effort at getting information from a young man, a Canadian, who was a 16-year-old held at Guantanamo. I was so upset, I could hardly listen.
I think it was one of the most disturbing images that I've, and of course there have been so many disturbing images in the last few years, but there was something about this interrogation that I thought was especially disturbing, and maybe it's because, we have a 16-year-old at home. I think any parent who has a teenager knows what it's like to talk to a teenager, knows how, you know, the teenagers get emotional, they start crying, they don't want to look their parents in the face, the parents get impatient, you know, telling your child, you know, look me in the eye. I mean, there was an element to that interrogation, Diane, that just, to me, really sort of summarized what's it like to deal with a teenager. And it underscored the fact that this was a kid. And he's still in Guantanamo. He was alleged to have thrown a grenade that killed an American soldier. But that in and of itself is not a war crime. The problem for him is that his father was an associate of Osama bin Laden, allegedly, and the son was caught up in this, so he is identified as being an al-Qaeda member, which makes him a war criminal, and which accounts for him being in Guantanamo. Now, 6 years. This interrogation, as you say, was when he was 16 years old. That's back in 2003. He's still there. His trial still
hasn't been long. Interesting, because I heard some of the letters that Michel Norris read in reaction to your reporting, suggesting that any 16-year-old who throws a hand grenade has got to be ready for this kind of treatment. And perhaps there is that kind of reaction from some people out there. But doesn't it sort of point to the question of how much information you can glean from a young person, an older person, under those kinds of conditions, Hisham?
I mean, there was a sadistic element to this whole exchange, it was a flippant way, the way the interrogators were dealing with him and making fun of his pain and his complaints, and when he was pulling on his hair and complaining about his eyes and his ordeal. Look, if there is a good case against this fellow, whether he's 16 or 60, put him on trial. I mean, but to keep them indefinitely, I mean, this is these are the real issues underlining this whole crisis of Guantanamo, which is legal, moral, political, any way you look at it.
And now a federal judge has ruled that the first war crimes trial can proceed. What was that ruling about, Roy?
Well, Judge Robertson, who had led through an earlier ruling to the Supreme Court, itself getting involved in a very serious way and setting up a new set of rules at Guantanamo. This time, Judge Robertson said the trial against Mr. Hamdan, who is said to be a former driver of Osama bin Laden, that the case in Guantanamo should go forward. He was not actually ruling on the merits of the defense claims that it was an unconstitutional procedure. He said, hold the case, and then you can appeal it. He made it very clear that he had great questions about the constitutionality of the case itself. And this comes back also to Omar Khadr. You have to ask the question with this young man of exactly what is the crime against, you know, alleged against him. You know, in war, it is known that soldiers and anybody under instructions as a soldier is to kill the other side. And so the killing of an American is not a crime. It is not murder as such. What has made it murder in the American eyes is that President Bush determined that anybody on the fighting on the other side against the Americans in Afghanistan was an illegal combatant.
Without a true declaration of war.
Yeah.
Not on that, as Roy has pointed out, Roy is, you know, expert on war crime stuff, but there's under the Geneva Conventions, there is such a thing as an illegal combatant, but there's supposed to be a procedure under which that status is determined.
Yeah, and that didn't happen.
Right?
That didn't happen. There were no commissions or no investigations on the battlefield. It was just determined by President Bush as an order to everybody in Guantanamo. So from that point on, everybody in Guantanamo is an illegal combatant, whether they were legal or whatever they were doing.
What about former Attorney General John Ashcroft and what he had to say yesterday about these so-called torture memos, Hisham?
Well, we've seen the new and improved John Ashcroft, and John Ashcroft looks shiny and stellar compared to Alberto Gonzalez, and I think he's benefiting from that. And it's true that he backtracked on some of the memos and that essentially allowed certain interrogation techniques that most people in the world would consider as torture, like waterboarding, but the administration, including Mr. Ashcroft, continue to admit or claim that they do not amount to torture. I think he didn't say enough. He was not pressed as he should have been, and I think he received some accolades that I'm not sure he deserves.
I want to go back for a moment to Iraq, because we did see a number of suicide bombings this week, including two that killed some 30 police recruits in Diyala province. Iraqi forces are preparing a major offensive there. What's happened to this so-called status of forces agreement, Tom? Where is the U.S. on that? Where is the government of Iraq?
I think the more difficult question is the second one. Where is the government of Iraq? Because you have different you get different answers depending on who you're talking to in Iraq. Of course, Nouri al-Maliki is the prime minister, and with his ear to the ground politically, has been very outspoken about the need for a fixed withdrawal, fixed timetable for withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq. He's also been insistent that the United States proceed to give sort of full sovereignty to the Iraqi government. On the other hand, there was an interesting story in the New York Times this week where the reporter went out and spoke to the Iraqi generals who are really going to be responsible for securing their country. And what you saw there was some real uncertainty and fear about the prospect of American forces leaving Iraq. One general said, an army would love to work without any help, but let me be honest, for now we don't have that ability. So I think a sort of a more sober assessment coming from the commanders who will be responsible for the security of Iraq.
Nancy Youssef from our office in Washington has been in Baghdad and
talked with her on Monday.
Yes, and basically the Iraqi generals were saying essentially we need the Americans to monitor us. We need the Americans to throw in support if we're in trouble. We need them present for the time being. I think the broader context now is that there's an election coming up in October, November. We don't know exactly the date. And Maliki is trying to profile himself in a way before Iraqi voters as a nationalist, as a man who's going to restore sovereignty to Iraq. And, you know, to give him credit, he took a great risk in Basra earlier this spring. He took a risk in Sadr City trying to restore order, getting the Sadrists out of power, in a sense. And it's not as if it's really working perfectly, but it sure has the appearance of progress. And he needs this in order to get his own party reelected, basically.
Diane, the United States signed a number of SOFA agreements with some Middle Eastern countries and the Gulf and the region as a whole. But most of them, if not all of them, remain secret. Given the political atmosphere in Iraq and in Washington, elections coming in Iraq and in Washington, this would be impossible for the Iraqi government to do. That's one. That's part of the dilemma that they have. Already now they are facing this at the end of this month. And there are still serious problems. And you know the United States always, always insist on the fact that their troops cannot be indicted or be under the law of the host countries. That's one of the major issues. And it's going to be difficult for Maliki to accept. The other one is the ability of the American forces to conduct operations, military operations, without prior approval of the Iraqi government. The third one is the ability of the Americans to arrest Iraqi citizens. The fourth one, which is contentious and touches on Iran, the American control of Iraqi airspace. And the Iranians told Maliki in his face, any agreement such as SOFA you sign with the United States will be seen by us as a direct threat to our national security interests. And I think now the focus is shifting. They know that they're not going to sign a SOFA agreement in the classical sense, in the traditional sense. So now they've probably come up with something vague, ambiguous, that would allow them to say the Americans will remain through an agreement with the Iraqi government and not to go back to the United Nations, because Maliki doesn't want to go back to the United Nations. But they are still haggling over some of these details that are extremely difficult to write in a way that would be at the same time ambiguous, but allow them legally and politically to get away with it.
Hisham Malam, he is Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya TV, Washington correspondent for Anahar. This week we saw an Israel-Hezbollah prisoner swap. Tom, why did Israel agree to a prisoner exchange with Hezbollah on Wednesday?
Well, I think, Diane, there was a recognition that that this negotiation, as it were, had gone as far as it could. They were anxious to get the bodies back of these two Israeli soldiers who had been missing for such a long time, and it's in the context of what is, you know, on this very program, we've been very skeptical about the Israeli talks with Palestinians, with Syria, with Lebanon, and so forth. But there does seem to be a real seriousness right now in Israel about moving forward on this kind of talks front. And this was a small step that was essential to continue that forward movement.
Right.
Well, this broader context is interesting. Again, you have to look at the end of the Bush administration. They had been urging 2 years ago when Israel went to war in Lebanon, the Bush administration had actually urged them to go to war with Syria at the same time. And the whole of the Lebanon war was a disaster. It didn't help Olmert, and it didn't help Israel in any way. And the Bush administration's militarized approach to foreign policy didn't get them very far. So I think the Israelis are doing something that Barack Obama, by the way, has suggested, which is talk to your enemies. And the Bush administration seems to be, in the case of Iran, doing something similar.
But now Hezbollah is treating this as a victory, Hisham.
Hassan Nasrallah was very explicit. He was giddy. He was happy, and he won. In his speech, and it says, which occurred in a very triumphalist environment, he said clearly, 2 years ago, I promised you that I'm going to return all the prisoners, including most.
And how many actually went?
There were five prisoners.
Five.
Including one, the infamous one, which is really a problematic one, politically and morally and legally. Samir Kuntar, who was arrested in Israel in 1979 when he was 16 years old or 17 years old, and this man was accused of brutally murdering a 4-year-old Israeli girl, and he was supposed to stay in prison forever. And Nasrallah has been insisting on his release since the year 2000, and he promised in 2 years ago, I'm going to get them back, and he said, also, I'm going to, when he withdrew from the government, I'm going to force the Lebanese government to come up with a national unity government that would suit his own objectives. And he said, I succeeded, and he did succeed.
So does this put Israel in a weaker position against Hezbollah, Tom?
Well, I think that Israel has certainly. I mean, if you look at this historically, with the beginning with the war against Hezbollah, that as Hisham said was not successful. If you look at it as a series of events, I think you have to conclude that Israel is in a weaker position. Yes.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Roy Gutman, we had Russia and China blocking sanctions against Zimbabwe in the UN Security Council this week. Why?
The Russians are, in a sense, the leading player here. The Chinese tend to follow them. And the Russians have been playing very hard to get on all sorts of sanctions issues. In this particular case, do the Russians really want to carry the water for Robert Mugabe? I doubt it. But they certainly have felt in general that the Bush administration has given them short shrift and has not listened to them in any way. And so they're not going to be eager to pursue this. I mean, there is the interesting question of whether additional sanctions is going to work against Mugabe, so long as he has support from South Africa's leadership and the tolerance of the African Union. And sanctions is not something that Americans love to reach to as an all-encompassing solution, and it never really usually has any impact at all.
Of course, China and Russia also oppose an effort to hold Sudan's president responsible for war crimes. Is that going anywhere, Tom?
It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. There is, of course, the International Criminal Court is moving to bring genocide charges against Bashir. But, the question is how far would they be able to get over the Chinese objections?
Who are, and of course, still supplying arms.
Precisely. And one of the reasons that China has for opposing this prosecution is that if it were to be established that he was guilty of genocide, then China, by virtue of having supplied him arms, would be considered legally a party to that genocide and would put China itself in a jeopardized position.
And it will hurt Chinese business in Sudan and the rest of Africa. I mean, the Chinese have been at this dirty game for a long time, and in principle, they don't like the Russians. They don't want They claim that these sanctions are constitute interference in the internal affairs of these states, and they don't want also their behavior to be subjected to this kind of international scrutiny. And I think there's a great deal of hypocrisy because the Africans themselves, African leaders, African political classes throughout the continent don't want to face the fact that they have people like Omar al-Bashir and Robert Mugabe who are really engaged in wars of genocide or incredible amount of inflicting incredible amount of pain on their own population.
And well, South right. Africa's president has not been a great assistant.
Mbeki has
here.
Been, in fact, has been very much
the lifeline of Mugabe, unfortunately.
Of Mugabe, but you know, thank heavens for Nelson Mandela, yeah. who at his 90th birthday celebration in London basically denounced Mugabe and all the pain he's inflicted on Africa. I wanted to say, though, one thing about Sudan, that, you know, the story that didn't get covered in anywhere near the amount it should have been is that UN peacekeepers who were sent by the Security Council, supported by the UN, were attacked by a group which is almost certainly a government in origin, and seven were killed. And, you know, Mr. Ocampo from the International Criminal Court really could add that to his bill of attainder against Bashir, because without the UN peacekeepers in Darfur, there is really no protection for the locals. Mm-hmm. But if the government is going to send in its army in disguise or in any form it wants to, and then attack them in a frontal way, in a way that the UN has pretty well proven, then it's all over for Darfur.
Roy Gutman, he's foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers. And when we come back, we'll open the phones for your comments and questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mad Men was just nominated for 16 Emmys. This AMC series, set in a Madison Avenue advertising agency in the early 60s, was created by Matthew Weiner, who wrote for The Sopranos. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Weiner. The new season of Mad Men starts this month. The first just came out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with Hisham Mellem. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya TV. Roy Gutman, he's foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers. He's the author of How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. And Tom Gelton, he's a correspondent for National Public Radio. This first email just really gets me. It's from Jay in Arlington, Virginia, who says, I cannot imagine why Israel would exchange someone who crushed the skull of a 4-year-old girl while her horrified mother looked on and accidentally suffocated her baby to keep her from crying for the bodies of dead soldiers. I would be surprised if the two soldiers would have wanted that. I understand the situation in Israel and Palestine is complex, but why would Israel let him go, and why would Hezbollah even want this man back? Hisham.
The Israelis resisted for a long time demands for the release of this man. One of the saddest chapters is that in 1985, when the group that this man used to belong to, so-called Palestine Liberation Front, headed by the infamous Abul Abbas, hijacked the Achille Lauro in the Mediterranean and asked for his release, and the Israelis refused. So they kept refusing until recently, and for understandable reasons. This man is accused, and apparently there were eyewitnesses to his ugly deed, and he did kill that 4-year-old girl. And his and her mother was hiding and smothered her 2-year-old child so that she will not be found out. And allegedly, this man also shot the father of the girl in the back. Exactly. So that was the most jarring thing to me to watch, because I watched and I heard television in Lebanon and the region how they covered it. It's one thing to exchange remains of bodies of combatants. It's a humanitarian gesture. It's good for the families. I mean, everybody deserves that. There is a certain sanctity to death, regardless of your political views. It's good for those remnants of people who died to go back to Lebanon, and the two Israeli soldiers to go back to their parents in Israel. And exchange prisoners, that's fine, especially if they are engaged in as combatants. And the four other Hezbollah members were taken prisoners by the Israelis when they attacked Lebanon in 2006 after the Hezbollah crossed the border. The most jarring thing is for this man to be treated as a hero by Hezbollah and other Lebanese and other Arabs. And that, to me, was the most painful, jarring, disgusting thing to watch on Wednesday.
Tom.
And Diane, Be clear here. Just a few minutes ago, we were talking with some sympathy about the plight of a 16-year-old in Guantanamo, Samir Kuntar, when he carried out this incredibly brutal act, was himself just 16 years old.
But he never showed any remorse, Tom. That's the other side of it. Never showed any remorse about this whole thing.
And here's an email from Charles who says, "Diane, I could not believe you felt sorry for this teenager at Gitmo. He was throwing grenades at our American troops, trying to kill them. He deserves whatever he gets. He knew what he was doing." Roy.
Well, in war, this is what happens. You attempt to kill the other side, and they attempt to kill you. And this is unfortunately what war is all about. It's so very different from the case of Samir Kuntar, who was going against civilians and shooting and killing and maiming civilians. There's a world of difference.
All right.
The other thing, Diane, is that we're not entirely sure that the boy, in fact, did throw a hand grenade. The evidence is murky, and it's really never come to light in a trial.
And yet that interrogator believed very strongly that this young man had committed this act.
But see, the underlying fundamental issue here also, it's legal and political. If there is evidence against this fellow, why keep him for 5 years? I mean, put him on trial under whatever law, and we're discussing it with Roy as to what law is applicable, but that's the real dilemma we're facing
here. All right, let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Harry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'd like to point out that I'm retired military myself, and I have lived and worked in the Middle East in many areas. And I'm going back to that young 16-year-old Canadian. As for him being 16, I want you to remember that many of our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are themselves only 18 or 19 years old. So screw the age. That doesn't count.
Tom?
Well, You know, there's so many different ways to look at this, Diane. I mean, one of the issues is the intelligence value. This kid was 15 years old at the time that he was taken into custody. He's now 21. 6 years have passed. He has never had a trial at which he was able to defend himself. He is held allegedly because of the intelligence that he may possess. But how much intelligence does he have at this point? And so, I mean, there are many ways to look at this. And it's absolutely true that, whether you're 16 or 18 or 19, you have to take responsibility for your actions. But, in our judicial system in this country, we do treat 16-year-olds differently from adults. I mean, that's just a fact.
Well, he was a child soldier, and we don't know the circumstances under which he came to be fighting there or what really happened in the incident itself. So I think prejudging him from this distance is wrong. And, with respect to the listener, we don't know the facts.
All right. Let's go to Bruce in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi there, Bruce. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks morning. For taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is this. Do your guests think that possibly the Bush administration is trying to react with Iran from fear that Barack Obama may upstage them some way, similar to what Jesse Jackson did with Libya some years ago?
I don't think Barack Obama is about to launch freelance negotiations with anyone. I think he's a wise enough man and he has solid enough advisors not to do that.
But here's another point of view from Gary, who says, I'm sorry, but I think there is the possibility that these discussions with Iran are a smokescreen to start another war. I fear our negotiator will come back and say, we tried everything, but they were there for publicity only. Bush will then be able to say, we tried everything, and now we go to war.
You know, Diane, one of the interesting things about this situation is the interaction between war preparations and diplomatic preparations. I mean, you can read this either way. Last week, there were a lot of bellicose statements from the Iranian side, also from the United States side, that made it appear that they were sort of bracing for war, but it could also be seen as posturing in advance of the negotiations. On the other hand, you can also make an argument that showing all this listener did, that showing all this interest in negotiations may in fact be a way to sort of prepare the way for war. Making war and diplomacy are closely related, interact with each other, and it's really hard to separate preparations from one from preparations for the other.
All right. To Baloo here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for your show. Diane, I learned a lot from your show.
I'm glad.
I owe you a tuition payment one day. I'm not joking. Seriously, I learned a lot from you. My question is for your panelists. I heard you were mentioning al-Bashir and Mugabe. Why the international community always waits those kind of leaders to stay in power 28, 30 years, and then dismantle their own country. And then after that, we start crying. Let's see example in Ethiopia. Malla Zeinawi is almost 18. He has two or three more left. 21 years in power. He's killing a lot of people. Why we are waiting those long times and then come back to charge them genocide and others?
Roy.
You know, the worry I have with your noble comments in a way is that, you know, that we shouldn't allow people, the tyrants, to suppress the human rights of their people, is that there's a big world out there. There are many countries where this happens. We can't be everywhere. We don't want to use military force everywhere. And the world has to build up a willpower to actually do anything, and at least to put the spotlight on these places. That's the first thing we should do.
All right.
What we do then is really tough.
To Bert in Peoria, Illinois. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wondered if anybody, I found it ironic, if anybody else did. Right on the 4th of July, we would hear, commentators read the Declaration of Independence with music in the background. And one of the things in the Declaration of Independence, one of the complaints we had against the British was that they had asked for their troops to to be exempt from prosecution in any crimes in the colonies, and that's exactly what we are resisting in Iraq. I'd just like to hear your comment.
All right, thanks for calling, Tom.
Well, as Hisham mentioned earlier, this is one of the elements under negotiation in the Status of Forces Agreement. The United States is clearly concerned that, I think from the U.S. point of view, that the Iraqi government and Iraqi judicial institutions are not yet mature enough for the United States to really trust them to be fair about this. The United States is not in Iraq. The United States would not say it's in Iraq as a colonial power the way that Great Britain was in the American colonies. So it is a somewhat different situation. On the other hand, the principle, you know, is certainly one worth debating.
All right. To Pembroke Pines, Florida. Good morning, Nelson. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm a combat wounded Vietnam veteran. I served in the United States Marine Corps. I'm also a retired fireman. I just want to say that many of the comments that I keep hearing on your show really make me wonder if some of your guests really care about the security and the safety of the United States of America and of its citizens. To look at the age of so-called combatants and try to put a certain favor towards that age is really perplexing to me. When I was in Vietnam, many of the enemy soldiers that I had to fight against were themselves teenagers. I was 18 when I went to Vietnam. At the age of 19, I was a squad leader in charge of the lives of other 18 and 19-year-olds in the bush. So to put age as a factor and to constantly try to make excuses for those who are trying to murder us is absolutely mind-boggling to me. How about standing up for America once in a while?
Nelson, I thank you for your call. Roy.
Listen, the fact is this is a nation of laws. This is a nation with a constitution. The United States is a party to the Geneva Conventions. It's part of the Land Warfare Manual. All of the contents of the Geneva Conventions, or practically all of them. And so the question is whether the United States observes the rules that it has itself agreed to through a constitutionally agreed process, namely the Senate has approved them. And in this case, President Bush himself decided to suspend the rules unilaterally and without consultation, and certainly without consultation with the Congress. The rules that he suspended were the Geneva Convention's application of the law of combatancy. Combatants are allowed to kill other combatants. And Bush decided that the other side were illegal combatants. Is this true? We don't know. In fact, there's a lot of reason to suspect that President Bush was doing this simply because he wanted to hold people indefinitely.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tom.
One other point, Diane. It's not just the liberal media or commentators or bleeding hearts who are paying attention to this guy's age. The U.S. military in Iraq treats juvenile prisoners differently from other prisoners for the reason that they consider them more subject to rehabilitation, more malleable. They get there's an entirely different procedure for treating juvenile prisoners in Iraq for that very reason. So it's not just a matter of sympathy, it's a matter of sensibility.
And beyond that, I mean, when you are an 18-year-old or 19-year-old and a member of a conventional force, like the American military in Vietnam or anywhere else, I mean, you are subjected to certain laws and procedures and certain commands and ethics and legal framework. I mean, wars are conducted according to certain rules. I mean, the Geneva Convention, as Roy mentioned. So it's different than this category that we've seen in Africa and the Middle East and other parts of the world. Soldiers who are children. And we don't know exactly how they were drafted, how they were forced, how they found themselves in these positions. And to treat them as you treat adults who belong, let's say, to the Viet Cong or to the insurgency in that place or another is different. And beside that, I have no problem. Personally, I have no problem punishing 16-year-old boys and girls, if they did something wrongful, if we can establish it and put them through a legal system that is recognizable internationally as acceptable and it is fair. I have no problem with that, whether he's in Guantanamo or anywhere else. My gripe is, why keep them indefinitely? Why not try them according to whatever law that you can come up with that is fair and transparent and legal and not embarrassing to us? That to me is the main issue.
Last question. Going back to the negotiations with Iran, the U.S. willingness to sit down. This from Jeff in Alpine, Texas. Does the reversal of policy by the Bush administration on Iran have anything to do with Iran's recent success with missile technology, or is the alignment of these two events merely coincidental? Roy.
Well, the tests of missiles that took place in Iran about a week ago seems to have been somewhat overstated and, in fact, embellished by the Iranians. They exactly. they faked some of the pictures. They overstated the range of some of the missiles. And it was nothing new.
Most of them were not long range.
Yeah, and there was nothing really new about
it. And finally, do you expect something worthwhile to come out of these negotiations? Tom.
You know what, Diane? I think it depends on the Iranians. I think they have a real tough decision here. Do they really want to improve relations with the West, get out from under the grip of sanctions? They're under strong economic pressure to improve conditions for their people. I think they have a tough decision to make.
Tom Gelden, correspondent for NPR, Hisham Mellem, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya TV, and Washington correspondent for Annahar, and Roy Gutman, foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all so
thank
much.
You,
thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.